Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello, and welcome to My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton Stevens, and My Time Capsule, as it's always been, is the podcast where people tell me five things from their life that they wish they had in a time capsule. They pick four things that they cherish and would like to see again, and one thing that they'd like to bury and forget. My guest in this episode is from a TV programme that always makes me and most of the nation cry every time. It's the master goldsmith and brilliant jewellery repairer from the wonderful The Repair Shop, Richard Talman. Now, for Richard, a childhood obsession with gemstones meant that after leaving school, he joined the famous Sir John Cass Faculty of Arts in Whitechapel, East London. Then he studied a City and Guilds diamond mounting course, starting his apprenticeship with a well-respected goldsmith in Hatton Garden. He entered the UK Fine Jewellery Competition, where he won first prize, and he went on to represent the United Kingdom at the 36th World Skills Competition in 2001 in Seoul, and took seventh place in the world. He completed his apprenticeship with the Goldsmith Company and became a freeman, and the following year he was awarded the Freedom of the City of London. Since then he's become a member of the Institute of Professional Goldsmiths, and in May 2005 was made a Fellow of the Institute. He runs his own bespoke jewellery making company, RTFJ, standing for Richard Talman Fine Jewellery, obviously, and is a regular on The Repair Shop, where he works miracles on fragile pieces of jewellery that are of great importance to their owner for various reasons and brings them back to life. Richard recently launched a range of jewellery called Emmalise, a combination of the names of his two daughters. So, as a fan of the programme and his astonishing skill, I was delighted to get the chance to ask Richard what five things from his life he'd want in a time capsule. And here's what he told me. Have fun.
Very good morning to you.
Hello, Richard. How are you? Lovely to meet you.
Likewise. An absolute pleasure.
Oh, yeah. There we go.
That's my alarm telling me to get online.
That's how organised you are. Yes.
Absolutely. Very good. Yes. So thank you very much for having me.
No, my pleasure. I mean, anybody who comes from my world and watches your world through the joys of The Repair Shop, you just go, oh, my God, how on earth do you do that? And I know the answer to that. That's years of dedication.
That's all I know, unfortunately.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know much, so I'm not complaining about it. I think it's an extraordinary skill. You are absolutely at the top of your game, aren't you?
Oh, that's very, very kind of you to say so. I'm sure there's others out there that are equal, if not better. Humble is my key to success, Michael.
So, yeah, but the lovely thing is that you have that thing where you can look at that skill
and then see that through history,
yes.
You can look back and say, at certain times, there were people like me who just had this skill, this ability to take those metals and to mould them and to make them look perfect. And that's a fantastic thing.
I mean, in a lot of cases, I would say that exactly what you've just said indicates to me that there were people with more skill, because my workshop is pretty much state of the art. I have invested every last penny I have ever had in the last 30 years into it. And I've got every single tool that everyone could need and more. And I use the word struggle loosely, but you look at some of these pieces that were made in like the 1800s when they didn't even have proper electricity or drills. And you're like, how did they make that with the tools they've got? So if anything, I would say that the skills were better then.
Yes.
If anything.
Yeah, no, I can appreciate that. Well, people use those sort of arguments to say that there must have been another power, because in a way, if you look at, you know, why are the pyramids so perfect? That's actually just people sitting down and being very, very careful.
Yes, absolutely.
Mm.
And maybe, you know, when you do have a lot more time to be able to do something, I mean, now, for financial reasons, when I have to make a ring, I have to make that ring in 2 days.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, you know, you're not making any money. And unfortunately, if you're not making any money, you can't survive. Whereas maybe back in times where maybe money wasn't quite such an influence.
No.
Maybe you had 4 or 5 times the amount of time, and especially with the pyramids, as you quite rightly said, how long did it take?
Yeah, yeah.
Who knows?
All those things, artwork, you know, so with sculptures, do you wonder whether, in fact, they had about 4 or 5 goes at it, and then at one point the arm fell off, and you went, oh, God, here we go, start again. But, you know, when you're dealing with tiny, tiny little amounts of gold and what would have been incredibly precious jewels at the time, because they wouldn't have had the skill, I don't think, to know exactly where to look or to have the mining equipment. So that's really what made them so precious, isn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm. And, of course, being formed from your precious metals, which, you know, still to this day, there was a theory. It was back when I started in the trade 30 years ago, and I'm pretty sure the figures are going to be fairly accurate now, and that is all of the fine gold that is ever mined would only have filled 7 Olympic swimming pools.
Right. Wow.
And the platinum that was ever mined would only fill one of them up to your ankles. It was said back then. So it has always been a form of showing one's wealth by carrying precious metals.
Yes, absolutely. Do you know, my uncle was a jeweller,
really?
But I wouldn't put him in the terms of, you know, like you're a jewellery maker.
I'm a goldsmith is mine.
Goldsmith.
Is what I would call myself. But we're all jewellers at the end of the day, because we're still selling the products.
Yeah, true. And that's what he did. He had a shop in a place called The Blue, which is a shopping centre in Bermondsey in southeast London. And he had been a docker. But when they made everybody redundant from the docks, they gave them a massive payout. And he went to Hatton Garden, which I know you worked at, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
And he just went in and said, you know, how much is that necklace? Can you do it for cheaper? And then he started selling them out of a council flat.
People wouldn't have minded.
No.
People would have gone for the cheapest option.
Oh, absolutely. Well, they did. As a boy, I remember seeing queues of people only on a Friday evening. So after they'd been paid, people would turn up there and turn their pay packet into gold, so they would then wear it, which is a very working class thing, isn't it? That you actually wear your wealth.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they sound like my kind of customers.
Yeah. And that turned into this enormous thing. He became a very wealthy man. Bless him. He's gone now. He's gone now, but I still have some pieces of jewellery that he sold us, sold the family.
Sold them. Love that. I absolutely love that. I might have to try that one myself. But his legacy lives on, of course.
Of course. But I also love, Richard, the idea that, do you feel as if you're a pioneer when you say to people, look, if you've got something hanging around that you never use, we can turn that into new jewellery. And I think that's such a brilliant idea.
It's something that I have always done for the reasons of, I have a hatred of waste. And this is what ultimately got me onto the repair shop, was their findings of my ethos. But that's not just extended to the world of jewellery. That is extended to anything. You know, I'm a little bit of, I hate throwing things away, you know, for no reason. And as I explain to people, when people have got an amount of gold, and they have no use for it, the price for what we call scrapping it, i.e. it goes back into the system, it's considerably less than what we call the raw bullion price. Considerably.
Right.
You know, in some cases, half. So I say, there's no point you selling this material for scrap and then using that money to buy new.
Yeah.
You might just as well take that. And not a lot of people offer that service because, to be quite transparent, most jewelers, high street jewelers, or not most, some, a proportion, will be buying pre-made jewellery. Pre-made jewellery that's made en masse, and therefore they haven't got the opportunity to convert it into new items. Whereas we have, you know, in our workshop, it takes only a matter of minutes to take some old chains, once, of course, you've checked their purity, and turn them back into a piece of bar identical to the size that we would buy from our supplier. And that's just a few minutes, and I mean a few minutes, you know, 5 minutes tops, and it's ready to go. So,
and you have the authority to mark those as well, do you?
No, not at all. So the marking for a purity mark of a piece of jewellery can only be legally done by an assay office. And there's currently four main ones in the UK, but there are certain companies that have subsidiaries. Like there's one at Heathrow Airport, and there's one in some of the casting houses, but they're all undergoverned. So we're not allowed to mark. And that is a huge criminal offence if we try.
Right.
We can stamp what we call our sponsor's mark. So every person who has a registered mark with the assay office has a sponsor's mark. So mine is RT in two triangles like that.
Right.
So I get to stamp that. I'm allowed to do that. But then it has to be submitted to the assay office. You tell them what purity you believe it is. And then they test it. And then they stamp the mark and it comes back. But, you know, the mark is... it's incredibly basic. I'm not going to lie. I'm fairly sure that someone out there, you know, they could replicate it, but it would be more than what you would dare do.
And as we all know from watching things like Antiques Roadshow and all those sort of stuff, age is not necessarily a guarantee of value.
No. Age has no. And also, sadly, with jewellery, value is subjective, very, very subjective. You can have a piece valued or for insurance purposes at many, many thousands. But that's value is how much it would cost an insurance company to reinstate that article in the event of a total loss.
Right.
It's a totally different end if you wanted to sell that item, because there's a price for buying and there's a price for selling, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that value doesn't necessarily mean it has to be valuable or new or old. It's how much value someone places in it. And indeed, some of the most valuable pieces I've ever worked on have had no value at all.
Right. Yes, but it's a lovely idea, isn't it? As I think I mentioned earlier, the idea of the history of it, that in fact, when you put your mark on that piece of jewellery that you've just made, it must go through your mind occasionally that maybe, you know, in 250 years' time, somebody say, oh, right, get the little eyeglass out and go, oh, well, he was a very good maker, actually, Richard Tolman. You know, yeah, this is his mark. I recognise that. I've seen a number of his pieces. No, it's a lovely idea, isn't it?
It really is a lovely idea, but one of those ones you're never going to know is true or not. I will hang on to the thought that one day someone will be cherishing my work. That was that guy from the repair shop, you know. Do you remember when we used to watch tellies on the television? Do you remember back in those days? Now we've got lenses in our retinas or something.
Almost,
we just turn on while we're walking down the road. Who knows?
Yeah. Who knows? It's a lovely program, though. I'm sure we'll talk about it, but we need to talk about five things you've chosen to put into a time capsule.
Yes.
Which I'll be very interested to see what you've chosen.
Absolutely.
Because it's quite a journey that you've been on.
Yes, indeed. And the five items I've chosen have had or do have very significant parts to play in my life, which kind of, you know, have parts to play on the person who you are today. So, you know, I'll start when you're ready.
Yeah, no, I'm absolutely ready. Let's hear what number one is.
Well, number one would be many items, and it would be my collection of my rocks and minerals. Now, this has so much of a story in my life. So to simplify what I mean by my rocks and mineral collections, I'm talking organic rough pieces of crystal as they have been pulled out of the earth.
Right.
Now, they can be found in many places. You know, you see like jagged crystals. That's the sort of thing. And I collected this from a very early age. And I can't remember what that age was because my memory doesn't serve me as long as what I had for dinner last night. But my mum and dad assure me that it was a very early age. And they reckon it was about 5 years of age.
Right.
We used to holiday in this country all the time. Oh, in fact, I never went abroad with my parents, but they would take us around heritage sites, if you like. And always at the end of these heritage sites, you would go into like the gift shop.
Yes.
And in the gift shop, still to this day, you will find anything from polished pebbles all the way up to these crystals and gems. Now, I became like a magpie of these. And with my minimal allocation of pocket money, which I was given back then, that's what I chose to buy. I recall my sister would always choose an ice cream or something, and I chose to get a gemstone, and I would treasure these like a little magpie. Mm. I probably even gave them names or something. I was quite a weird child. And I've got photos of this collection as it grew on my bedside table. And it started off just by having one item, two items, and then I bought, or my parents bought me, a very small cabinet that I could start putting them in. Right. And it just grew and grew and grew, all the way from very insignificant pebbles all the way up to really nice crystals. Now, it was this very collection which, by the time I was maybe 10, I had cherished this, and I developed it just from, oh, this is a shiny rock and a stone, to actually knowing about the crystal. Oh, this is a quartz crystal. Mm. So this is a piece of amethyst. Amethyst is a piece of quartz. This is a piece of sapphire. Oh, this is a corundum mineral. So I started to know a little bit more. I'm not a gemologist by any sense of the imagination. I'm nowhere near that skilled.
But a bit of a geologist.
Exactly that one, yes. So it was this collection of minerals, coupled with my father, of whom I had the most incredible relationship with. Sadly, he passed away late last year. I had the most incredible relationship with him, but he was a hands-on father in the way of being creative. He would never take us, not wishing to speak ill, he would never like take you to a park or anything and kick a ball around. He would say, you know, let's do something creative. And he was a coppersmith by trade. And he taught me from a very early age metalwork, sheet metalwork. So he's taking me down the park. He'd say, right, well, here's a bit of metal. We're going to make something out of it. So I was competently gas soldering by the time I was 8 or 9. Wow. So this rocks and mineral collection, coupled with the art of metalwork, which my father taught me, meant that by the time I went to secondary school, by the age of 12, it was an obvious course of action for me. I absolutely loved metalwork and I absolutely loved gemstones. Mm. What more could someone want to do? So this collection of rocks and minerals, by some stroke of luck, I guess, taught me or encouraged me to get into the trade, of which is all I know and it's all I ever have done and it's all I'm ever likely to do.
Yeah, but clearly something you love. So if it goes that far back, I wonder what it was that first led you to be fascinated by them. I wonder if it was just the, you know, all that glistens is not gold, you know, if it was just the fact that they look so beautiful, or in fact, if once you'd learned anything about the geology of it, or the time involved in the making of it, or the rarity, that sort of thing.
It would be very hard to say, because my memories, I have very vague memories back of then. And I distinctively remember, you know, actually being taken by my father to go and buy this little cabinet because they felt sorry for me that they were collecting dust. Mm-hmm. I remember that moment like it was yesterday, but I guess it was just the shininess and the fascination and the naturalness of what we do. And of course, the world that I'm in today, making pieces of jewellery, it is quite lovely to know that those are as natural as things come, even though they have been very much manipulated by humans. Those gemstones, as I mount them in a piece of jewellery, they don't look like that when they come out the ground. In fact, when you show people a rough sapphire, they go, oh my God, or a rough diamond is the most bizarre thing to look at, because it looks like a piece of glass washed up on the beach, a rough diamond.
Yeah.
It is only the cutting of a diamond at the angles, the correct angles, which causes it to reflect the light.
Mm.
So there is a lot of human manipulation that goes into making them that beautiful, but they are still natural minerals.
It's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? The time and detail and the amount of error that would have gone into discovering those skills.
And the amount, again, one of the reasons why I take my hat off so much to other people's work, like, for example, like the diamond cutters.
Yeah.
So my apprentices, over the course of time that I've taught, you teach them on precious metal. And then when they make a mistake, which is inevitable because we all do, you get to melt it down again. You say, well, that didn't work out. Put a flame on it, melt it down. We can reuse it again, which kind of leads me to have so much respect for like the diamond cutters. You know, you can't, or even a carpenter or a joiner, they don't get that privilege and that pleasure.
No.
Once they've messed up a piece of wood, it's firewood. Once I mess up a piece of metal, it gets a second chance.
Yeah. And imagine having one of those huge rocks in your hand and somebody saying, well, we need to cut this down to whatever it is inside it. I mean, it's beyond my comprehension, that the fact that they can look at this thing, study it and say, well, you know what this is? This is seven smaller diamonds and one really big one.
Absolutely. This is the art of a tradesman called a cleaver. So from a miner, it will then go to a cleaver and then to a cleaver to a cutter. So the cleaver will look into the stone, and what he or she would be looking for is where the imperfections are and how to cut that rock to get the maximum amount of stones, clean stones from it. Mm-hmm. Because the last thing you would want is to cut yourself a really lovely, beautiful, bright diamond and it have a black dot, which is known as a PK, right on the top. So they mark around it with Indian ink and cleave it to get the best crystal to then cut the stone from.
Amazing. Absolutely fantastic. I mean, very few people actually own those amazing things, which is why the value of them just leaps and leaps as the size increases, isn't it? To the point where they're incalculably expensive.
It's all, yes, indeed. It all comes down to consumerism and the supply and the demand. So most people listening to this would know if I was to describe a diamond as being a carrot. Now, that's not the carrot, the orange thing. That's a carrot, C-R-A-T. And that has a very funny story as to why it's called a carrot. I can touch base on that in a minute. And 1 carat's worth of diamond is a very... It's a very wanted item. Everyone says they want a carrot because it actually sounds good. But when you ask a customer, you say to them, what is a carrot? You say to some customers, they say, oh, well, it's a big diamond. It's a good diamond. And it's quite simple. 1 carat is 0.2 metric grams. As simple as that, it's a weight.
Right.
So I often say to people, why don't you have a 95-pointer diamond? So the points to carat is like pence to pound. So a 95-pointer is almost a carat. Mm-hmm. But because it hasn't hit a carat, it's a cheaper stone. You can be saving £500 easily on a similar grade of stone to a carat.
Mm. I rather like the different cuts as well. I like the fact that now we have that brilliant cut, usually on a diamond. But I like the Victorian cut, where in fact it's slightly duller. It doesn't shine as much. But I find them really attractive.
They are. They are so attractive. And even a diamond doesn't have to sparkle in order to make it beautiful, because some cuts are not necessarily sparkly stones, like what we would call an emerald cut. It doesn't have so many facets on it to bounce back off the light. So some diamonds just glisten and would almost blind you. Others are more sedate, if you like. But all of them carry a certain amount of beauty.
Yeah. Well, go on, tell me why it's spelt carrot that way.
So folklore would have this. I can't be quoted. There is a type of tree, and I can't tell you what the tree's name is, that produces beans, carob beans.
Yeah.
And in those carob beans are carob seeds. And it is one of the only plants, apparently, that was known to always have a consistently accurate size seed within it.
Wow.
So the carob bean would be open and each of those carob seeds would all weigh identical. Now, this was going back to the times where they would be using pan scales.
Mm.
So a diamond and other precious stones would be weighed in accordance to the carob seed. So you would say that this diamond weighed 1 carob seed, 2 carob seed. And over the course of the years, as words get lost in translation, carob became carrot.
Right. Ah, okay. Well, I'd guess at that tree being called a carob tree. But
Most likely. Well, I mean, acorns don't come from acorn trees. So
no, very true. Very
not,
true.
I'm not a horticulture expert, but yes, most likely a carob tree, quite.
Yeah,
yes.
But that's most of my life, just plumping for things. You know, I don't need to know it. I just have a guess. Well, what a fantastic thing. I love it when children become involved in something that then leads them to their life, as it were. My grandson is absolutely brilliant at the shapes of countries. I mean, he does that worldle thing first time, every time. Show him the shape of a country, he knows the country. It's because he's studied maps endlessly. And you sort of think, well, that's great, because in fact, maps are necessary. People will always need to work on them. In the future, obviously, clearly, we'll have satellites and we have computers and things, but you still need someone to look at it and go, yes, that's right.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Even in the world of AI, I don't think the human eye will ever be substituted personally.
No.
I hope so anyway.
No, absolutely, yeah. Otherwise, we will all just start accepting mistakes, I think. And they'll say, well, they accepted it, therefore it must be right. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. But I love the fact that you see it in certain children. There was a boy at school, when I was at school, who, if you wanted to know which train to catch, you asked him, because he was obsessed with train spotting. And of course, he ended up working in the ticket office at Orpington Station and was as happy as a sandboy. Am I allowed to say sandboy? I don't know what that is. He was an extremely happy man.
Well, again, an absolutely fascinating story and a lovely story, because that is when you work doing what you love, that makes you happy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rest of it just works its way around it. And of course, children's brains are like sponges growing up.
Yeah.
So you can probably get more into your brain in the earlier years mm-hmm. than you could later years, possibly. So it's lovely stories.
You never lose. I mean, clearly you've never lost the fascination and the joy of it. That moment of having that thing and putting it in something that displays it beautifully as a ring or as an earring or on a bracelet. The joy of doing that and the fascination of having the skill to be able to do it, that's never left you.
Never.
You only have to see you when you take... I mean, I've seen you do some extraordinary things on the repair shop. Just really moving. It is really moving that you take something that is so treasured but so destroyed and turn it back into the thing that the person loves. It's a beautiful thing.
Thank you. Thank you. It means the world to hear that from a viewer, because we hear it from the contributors that we're actually fixing the piece for, and naturally they're very delighted.
Of course.
But it's so lovely to hear that from viewers, because that is the whole ethos of the show. And the show is in its, oh my God, well, I've been working on it for 7 years and I came in on series 3 and it is one of the few, and the reason why I think it's so successful is it's one of the few things that are on telly today, which is actually, it's purely 100% kind. There is no other ulterior motive to the repair shop other than kindness. And what has to be remembered about what's being done here is we are being given the pleasure and the honor of working on items for people, which is sometimes their only memories, their only tangible asset of a deceased loved one.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes these pieces coming in, the people bringing them in, don't actually know what they originally look like.
No.
Because the deterioration has happened over such a broad amount of time.
Yes.
You know, it's their grandfathers. Well, I can only just about remember what my grandfather looked like, let alone one of the assets that was his. Mm-hmm. So we're working almost sometimes with a kind of like a blank canvas in some cases. You can only, you know, work out and expect. But it really is absolutely magical. I feel incredibly honored to be part of it.
I'm sure, because as you say, the kindness and also the fact that the value of the thing is not monetary. It's absolutely what it means to people. And you know, I hope that, in fact, this podcast slightly reflects that, in as much as I'm not asking you to show me the most successful things you've ever done or the most famous, but I'm asking you to tell me the things that you most cherish.
Yes,
yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Great. Okay, well, we've got the first one, which is your collection of crystals. So let's find out what the second one is.
Well, the second one would be a particular bicycle that I have. And that bicycle was purchased in 1990. So we're talking 34 years ago. And believe it or not, that bicycle is still in my shed now, almost in the condition in which I bought it. And the reason why that meant so much to me is so many different reasons. I was taught, and I'm going to be referring to my family quite a lot in this because they were such role models in my life. My father also taught me to respect money and respect that things weren't given for free. He would always be there and he provided us obviously with a lovely home and nice food and blah, blah, blah. But if I wanted something that wasn't deemed a necessity, I had to work for it.
Right.
And I loved my bikes. In fact, I probably didn't really use public transport until I was probably 16. Not because I didn't want to use it, but because I used to cycle everywhere.
Yeah,
and not only I didn't just use it as a mode of transport, I used to do like competing, like off-road mountain biking.
Right.
And that was my passion from probably the age of 10 all the way up till I got a driving license and forgot all about it. And
this is easier.
Exactly. Yeah. Don't break quite so much sweat. And I always wanted, even though I was bought my first bike, I wanted a particular competition bike. Mm-hmm. And he and my mum said, "Yeah, well, of course we can get you one, but you know, you've got to work for it." And I remember I worked as a paper boy. And I remember my wage, it was £2 a day and it was £3 on Sunday. It's £15 a week. And I worked as that from the age of about, well, from until I was legally allowed to, up until I was probably 15 or 16. And I kept saving up. And every time I reached a figure of money, which I thought was going to be good enough to go and buy a bike, I'd go and look at one. And lo and behold, I had maybe £500. I'd find one that I wanted for £7. And my dad would go, "Well, if you want that, you go away and save. And anyway, to cut the long story short, it took me an amount of time and I got to the point where I had found enough money and I spotted this particular bike on holiday, because we used to holiday in this country, and it was in a town in Dorchester. It was Dorchester in Dorset. Mm-hmm. And we went in and I found this particular bike, and it was all I wanted. But lo and behold, I was a little bit short of it. My dad wouldn't put his hand in his pocket for extra bit. And at that point, I was quite cross. I just thought, oh, come on, I've got this far. But looking back at it now, it must have been so hard for him, because if my daughters wanted something right now, I'm so soft. I just buy it.
It's very difficult to deny them, isn't it? Very difficult. Yeah.
Very difficult. And maybe I'm doing the wrong thing because I've learned such a great ethos from them. Maybe I'm being a bit of a fool that I'm all too easy. But as they get older, maybe I'll get stricter. Yeah. And we left the shop. We left the shop and we wasn't to have it. But anyway, I got home and I proved to him that I could earn that little bit extra. And once we got back home to Sussex, he said, okay, fine, but you've proved, you know. And he phoned this company in Dorchester and we had the bike purchased and we had it packed up and we had it sent down to me. And I treasured this bike. I absolutely treasured it. I had another bike to ride to school with because I treasured it that much. Didn't want it mm-hmm. stolen. I would never leave it outside shops. And every time I went out mountain biking, as we called it, and it would come back and it would come back filthy, I would take it apart to clean it. And you know, even down to the bearings, I would strip the bearings.
Wow.
50 times more often than you should have done, which led me to become one of my first jobs, which was a cycle mechanic.
Right.
And I was a cycle mechanic at Halfords from the age that I was allowed, which I think mm-hmm. was 15. And that cycle mechanic job kept me going through my apprenticeship when I was a goldsmith.
Yes, of course. What make was it? Was it Muddy Fox?
No, it wasn't. It was a Trek 990, which right. I've only just realized 30 years on that coincidence that it was bought in the 1990s and it was called a 990. I'm sure there is no relevance, but I literally, that bike has been with me and I haven't cycled it for 20 years.
Right.
Because when I moved, I'm 45 now. So yeah, I moved out my parents' home when I was 21 and it went from their garage into my shed and it went from a shed into another. And I can pretty much say it hasn't been cycled for 25 years, probably 20 years, but I cannot part with it.
No.
Because it would be worth next to nothing. And it is my childhood memories, and it is mm-hmm. in such great condition. It's probably as dusty as, but if a little bit of work was to be spent on it, it would look like almost a new bike.
Fantastic. Well, as you said, you're not a man who likes to throw things away pointlessly.
No.
I mean, you actually went out and competed with it, though, did you?
Only competed amongst local clubs.
Right.
You know, so there would be groups of us that used to go out cycling, always on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. And you used to, the basic principle was to find the sharpest hill that you possibly could, get yourself to the top of it, and then launch yourself off it like a lemming.
Yes.
I knocked myself out a countless amount of times in coming off, and we all injured ourselves. But being young, we never had the fear. And just by coincidence, not too long ago, maybe within the last 5 years, I found myself back up at one of the very sites I used to launch myself off this hill. And I looked at it and said, there isn't a figure of money you could pay me to do that today.
What sort of idiot would jump off that thing? Yes.
Exactly. And we did. We'd get to the top, we would jump and we would launch ourselves and down we would go. And some of us got to the bottom in one piece. Most of us tumbled down in pieces, but we got back up again and we loved it. And I've got such unbelievably good memories of growing up as a child with that being my hobby and that being how I kept myself out of trouble.
And fit, no doubt about that.
Well, I don't know. I think I injured myself as much as keeping myself fit.
Fantastic. Well, let's put the 990 in. Wonderful. We'll have it cleaned up, obviously. I'm going to get somebody to take it apart down to the bearings and polish it up so that it's absolutely pristine.
Before it goes in that time capsule.
I'm going to repair shop it. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put it under a little blanket so I can reveal it to you. Fantastic.
Remember that day when I first saw it, yeah.
Yeah, oh, lovely. Okay, Richard, what's number three then?
Right, I hope you're enjoying this lovely conversation with Richard, but I'm sorry to say we have to, contractually, interrupt it for a moment and leave a gap in which adverts can be played. It might, in fact, just be a gap, in which case we'll be back after a short silence. Hopefully there will be a few appropriate ads, as they're the thing that pay for the making of this podcast. Either way, apologies and see you shortly.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome back. That wasn't too tough, was it? Of course, regular listeners to this podcast will know that the podcast is available ad-free if you subscribe to Acast Plus, details in the description of the pod. But for any newcomers, I thought I'd just mention it before launching back into the episode, which I'm going to do right now. Here we go.
Number three. So I'm a little bit of a petrol head, I'm afraid to say, and I wouldn't want to upset anyone that isn't. But I love cars, and I've got a real passion for cars. Anything that is remained around it, I used to race quads some time ago, quad bikes. So I love things that work with petrol, really. So cars are my thing. I'm afraid to say I haven't managed to amount a collection of Ferraris or Lamborghinis yet. My cars to date have been wage appropriate, should I say?
Yeah.
Or sadly, wage inappropriate, because I've always spent.
Just too much, yes.
Like, far too much.
Oh, right.
They've been within that radius of what could have been afforded. Sadly, the six figures aren't mine. And again, from when I could drive, I set my heart and I set my soul on a certain model of car. And that particular car, when I finally managed to buy it, it was a magnificent day, but it was the craziest day. And that car was an Audi RS4. Ooh. Okay, and that was a 2006 model. It was what they called the B7. But it wasn't just that. The thing that really made that car, is it had a 4.2-litre V8 in it.
Oh, my word.
And it was a manual. And it was for those exact pairing reasons that this car should go in a time capsule, because these cars aren't made anymore. No. They can't make, because of emissions issues, they're making smaller engines and turbocharging them, which is lovely, but from a true car enthusiast's mind, you don't get more raw than a naturally aspirated V8 engine with a manual box. And this is what this car had. And these cars are going to be non-existent in 20 or 30 years' time. And 100 years' time, even though there won't be any fuel to actually start them.
No.
Because we would have used out.
It's a strange thing, isn't it, that the roar of an engine will disappear, that actually the revving would disappear. I wonder if, in fact, some electric cars will bring in a system whereby they generate a sound, not necessarily just for petrol heads or for people who love that sound, but actually for safety reasons.
I really believe that should happen. I frequently cross the road with my ears.
Yep.
You know, I'll be walking along the road and I will listen and I'll just go, oh, there's no cars coming. And I'll cross, I'll go, because we've been brought up hearing the sound. But it's a very valid point.
Yes.
Very valid point.
Well, they have beautiful cars, those Audis.
I often refer to it as the best mistake I ever made, because it costs so much. I mean, I think I must have just been unlucky with this particular model, which sometimes people often say, well, why is it your best car? And I just say, well, because it was just so phenomenal and so amazing, but it constantly needed repairing and it constantly needed something else doing. It wasn't sustainable. And I often use the expression that people use about boats, and that was the day I The day I bought that RS4 was the second happiest day of my life, and the first happiest was the day I got rid of the bloody thing.
Yeah, yeah. If you can do it and you love it, I think you should do. There are some people whose lives are absolutely obsessed with it. Now, strangely enough, a little bit, I happen to know Nick Mason, who's a drummer with Pink Floyd.
Yes.
And he is so obsessed with vintage cars and Ferraris that he just has them remodeled. So if there's anything at all that's been changed from the original thing, he has it put back. So moving petrol caps a sort of half an inch and things like that.
Good for him.
Well, he can afford to, but, you know.
Good for him. Well, that's keeping the heritage of the item. And, you know, getting back to, like, the V8 engine and say that they just won't produce them. They're all going down to the V6s or even in comparison to the car I'm driving now, back to four cylinders, just heavy turbocharging it. The sound that was achieved from that, you know, and it redlined 8,500 revs. That was the maximum you could take it to. And believe me, the ironic thing was that car had was the first car I had with a truly decent Bose sound system in it. And I never listened to it because the biggest sound was having the windows down on a country road and taking it to that. And there's just the sound of that engine purring is... I don't know. I once watched a program with one of the Italian tenors and he said, people say our voices are great, but for me, the greatest sound in the world is a V12 Ferrari.
Right. Yeah. Well, we've done, in our times, human beings have done some extraordinarily daft things and things that now we look back on and say, well, you know, we were ruining the world. But I don't think that that means that you should stop enjoying them. And I think the same is true of those cars. I think we're absolutely right that we've decided the world can't deal with it and we have to change it.
Absolutely.
And I think let's change it fast. But there's no reason why you shouldn't still look at a thing like that and say, well, isn't that beautiful?
Engineering masterpiece.
Exactly.
Absolutely. Engineering masterpiece. And yes, indeed, we've all... there's a massive debate on the whole electric cars and I'm certainly not going to get into it because for one reason, some people will say this is good and others are bad. But yeah, things have got to change. A movement at some point has got to occur in order to prolong the world for our, not necessarily our grandchildren, but our great-great-grandchildren.
Yes. You wouldn't reject a beautiful piece of jewellery just because it was made for someone who was unfairly extraordinarily wealthy.
No. And that is another reason why the process that we call remodeling that we do is such a fantastic one, because the diamonds and the gemstones have already been mined. The gold has already been mined. And the amount of energy it takes to make it back to something new is little more than it takes to boil an egg.
Right. Yes. So it's a fantastic environmental way to make jewellery.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Is that part of the ethos of your new company? Emily's.
No, Emily's, that actually, sadly, it's quite the opposite, although it is all very ethically done. Mm-hmm. We find, being a bespoke jeweller, a bespoke goldsmith, most of our business from the manufacturing side is when people come to us with a concept, be it an engagement ring, wedding ring, or indeed just someone wanting to treat themselves, and we make it bespoke to their design. Mm-hmm. So often I'm spending, you know, half a day just designing and talking to someone. Yeah. And for that reason, by the time you've added bits and making, we cannot produce a piece of bespoke jewellery now for under four figures. Mm-hmm. It's £1,000 or multiples of.
Yeah.
And that's okay for people treating themselves who are in a position to do so. Mm-hmm. It's okay for someone to give us an engagement ring or a wedding ring or an eternity ring. But for what I call giftable jewellery, you know, that everyday, or I've got something for someone's 21st birthday, No normal person has that sort of money to spend. Fortunately, there are some people that do, and that's very great. But we were getting increasingly distressed, for want of a better word. Some of our best customers would come in and say, Richard, I want a pair of earrings for someone for a present. I've got a budget of £100. And I'll say, yeah, I'm so sorry, I can't make something. No. And we was turning them away in order to go just onto the internet or to the shops.
Yeah.
And they would come back to us not too long after with this piece of jewellery they bought and say, oh, it's broken. And it would break our hearts. So we, between myself and my colleague, we scoured some trade shows and we found suppliers who can supply us with what we call production jewellery. Mm-hmm. So our workshop's not kitted up for production. Our workshop's kitted up for one-off pieces. But a production workshop is where you're turning around 20 units at a time for the same amount of time. So we can sell them at a lot cheaper prices. They're not made by us. They're not made by us. And we make that clear to our customers. We have to be transparent. But we are giving...
But they're chosen by you.
They are chosen by us because we're looking at the pieces. It's almost like a research and development. When a pair of what we call articulated earrings, so you've got a piece that fits to the earlobe and a piece that jangles at the bottom. Mm-hmm. The part that wears out over time is the two little hoops where they link together. So we know when we're looking for the pieces of jewellery, not to buy the pieces with the thin little rings on it. We buy the pieces with the bigger rings on it so that they're not going to be presented with that problem. We're using our craftsman's eyes to buy pieces for everyday use.
So with your skill, you can guarantee that these will be cheaper, but they'll still be good.
Exactly that, Michael. Yeah, exactly that. And I never wanted to market those products under our brand because our brand is bespoke. So I needed to create a separate additional brand. It's starting off at jewellery, but it's going to extend to ethically sourced maybe things like, you know, handbags and purses. And and we wanted an original name. And I tried anagrams of myself and my wife's name and anagrams backwards and forwards. And it was just only one day I was sitting there and I glanced up at my desk and there's a picture of my daughter's just on the desk. And I looked at it and I just thought, well, maybe I could do something using their names. And their names are Emily and Alice, eldest and youngest. And I just split the name straight down the middle and joined them together, which joined Emily's. And...
Lovely. Well, very good luck with it.
Thank you.
I mean, clearly there's a need for it because, in fact, it seems to me that actually there are very few shops now that supply good jewellery.
I'm afraid... You know, without wanting to put any of my competitors down, that is indeed the case of, right, let's just get a product out there. No one, very rarely these days do people actually ask what the intended purpose is. They don't care. They just say, oh, well, they buy it and they sell it. And I get people coming in to us all the time and they say to me, this is the kind of ring I want to wear. And I say to them, oh, okay, fine. Can you tell me how often you're going to want to wear this ring? Oh, every day. Oh, right. What do you do for a living? And they tell me. And I say, this ring's not suitable. No. This ring will bend because you've asked for something so dainty. Mm. I was expecting you to say, I'm only going to be wearing it when I go out to evening dues, which is when something like that is suitable. So it's about asking the customer what it is they want. Find out what it is they want, find out what it is they need. And once you've ascertained all of those features, build something that is going to be correct and fit for purpose.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that phrase, fit for purpose, I think we'll put the Audi RS in. That certainly was. It did what it said on the packet.
It did. And any other V8 vehicles while you're about it.
Okay. All right then. Lovely. We've got two left, Richard. What's number four?
Only one good one. So one of my nice pastimes is a multitude of things. I'm a great fan of what is known as real ale. And I may be deemed as a bit too young, but I love a beer. I love a beer. And when I say a beer, I'm not talking, and I'm not going to mention any brand names here, but I'm not talking any fizzy lager rubbish because I have never drunk it. And even back when I was a kid, when I maybe shouldn't have even been drinking, I would be going to parties and friends would be drinking the aforementioned. And I'd arrive with a bottle of something called like Old Man's Beard or something, or silly names that these ales have. But I'm a great enthusiast of ales, and I love a bitter or any of these pale ales, and something that's been produced on a craft basis. And I just think that in Britain, we're very, very lucky, whilst not in any way condoning irresponsible drinking or anything. The British pub is, and I'm not the most well-travelled in the world, but the British pub can be found in no other country. Mm-hmm. The Great British Pub is such a fantastic place. And if you've got a local pub, like we're fortunate enough, we live in a lovely little village in Sussex, and we've got what I call a local pub where locals go and they have a nice drink, one or two, and they have a nice time at home. And that's one of my favourite things to do, is go for a nice pub walk and end up have a roast dinner or whatever. And so ales, a nice bottle of ale of my favourite type, is going to be something that I would definitely put into my time capsule.
Yeah.
For someone later to enjoy it would have got off by then, of course.
No, you never know. The great thing about the Great British Pub, I think, is that it's not about drinking. It's about being sociable.
Yes.
And you know, I've got a number of friends. We go for what is called our beer night on a Tuesday evening, where we sample beer, basically. We will try different beers. The thing about that, I think, is that you will drink far less. It's like drinking a good glass of wine. You will drink less.
Sip.
You enjoy the flavour. Yes.
Absolutely. And you go to a lot of these, we're most fortunate to have a lot of these craft pubs in and around us. And it is now not uncommon to go in and order a third or a half or what they call a schooner, which is a two-thirds, because some of them are quite high percentages now. We're going for much like the continentals, rather in the six and the sevens. Mm-hmm. Well, if you drink a couple of pints of six or seven, you know about it. And so it's quite normal in some of these craft pubs now to say, well, can I have a third of that beer? Because I want to try it. I want to enjoy it. And that's where my passion for it lies. It's not necessarily just drinking three or four pints of it. It's sampling the different ones.
And I have to say, as a man who, you know, over years has decided that I should drink less, there are now some amazing low-alcohol ales. And Guinness Zero is a piece of genius, I think.
I have no idea when I'm drinking Guinness Zero, which is my favourite non-alcohol beer, because I drink non-alcohol in the week now. I've, like yourself, I've got to the age where I realise that even two pints of beer can give me a hangover. Guinness Zero, for the first pint, I literally can't tell the difference. It's only when you've had two of them you think, okay, well, this isn't having the user effect, but it is an absolute mark of genius. And it's a lovely, again, it's a fantastic way that everyone's going. That 10 years back, if you walked into a pub and said, can I have an alcohol-free beer, you'd get a bottle of Beck's Blue or a bottle of Calibre, and they would rub it, and they were undrinkable.
Horrible.
Now you will get a selection, and even my local pub has a 0.0 on draft.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's great. I think it's a big move, isn't it? There was a report recently that said that actually the brewers are worried that there's a generation of young people who are coming through who don't like to drink.
Absolutely. And as time moves on, it's like, you know, the smoking movement, I think that will be outlined. I would love to think, with my two young daughters who are 6 and 4, I would love to think that by the time they're 18, smoking will pretty much be done and dusted.
Yeah, I hope so. Well, I'm going to put a lovely pub in there with a variety of ales for you. So you can go in there. There's a fire in the corner. I'm afraid there isn't a jukebox. It's just people sitting there having a chat.
Absolutely.
Oh, lovely. Okay. Well, unfortunately, Richard, all we have to do now is decide something you want to put in there because you'd like to forget it.
This is a very, very clear-cut one for me. And as I say, I hope it offends no one. My entire secondary school, for me, I'm afraid to say, I did not have a good time at secondary school. I had a very good time at primary schools because primary schools did what they are supposed to do, and primary schools are utterly fantastic. I see the wonderful, wonderful work they do for my daughters and making them thrive, and I feel very lucky that we're in a country that supports such a wonderful education system. But for me, back in the 90s, it was quite clear that I was not academic. It was so clear I stood out like a Belisha Beacon, but the schools didn't appreciate that back then.
No.
They sadly did not, and I'm not aware of any diagnosis of any learning difficulties, but my apprentice, who's now, I class him as my business partner, he's heavily dyslexic, you know, to the point where even taking down a name doesn't work for him. And he suffered a lot at school for that exact reason, because teachers, they wanted the results from the pupils. And rightly so. You know, when you do a job, you want to get results. So therefore, if there was a kid in the school, and this is just what I found at my school, I wasn't getting the results because I couldn't learn like other people. And I believe it is unfair. I'm not sure how the school system works now, because I've been out of it for nearly 30 years. But you either conformed to what they wanted to teach you on academia, and if you didn't, you were deemed stupid. And I was deemed stupid, and teachers had no interest in me after a while. And in fact, sadly, one of them actually humiliated me. You know, one of them made me stand up in front of the class, and he assured me with great, great, great accuracy. He said, "Talman, you will never make any success in your life." And I'll never forget him saying it. So, I'm not playing, the violin for me. I've recovered, but
well, he proved him wrong. That's what you've done. But, I hope that is changing. I still feel that there's an enormous pressure on schools to get results, and that actually schools are judged by their results.
Yes.
And they're not necessarily the sort of results that they should be getting. See, for example, you clearly had a skill, but they were not interested in that skill. It wasn't on their curriculum, as it were.
No.
So it didn't count. And that's not right. Children should be pushed in the direction of the thing that they want to do and that they love to do and that they're good at. I think that all children have a capability that, if sought out, will bring out the best in them.
Absolutely. And when we used to look at my school report, it used to just be, you know, unmentionable. And then you got down to craft, design and technology, as we used to call it, CDT. And I was top grade there because that was what I liked doing. But no one, again, you know, I didn't go to private school. I wasn't expecting any private treatment here. But no one picked up and went, and again, they shouldn't have done, because they were told that the government sets the standard of what they have to do, and the teachers do what the government tells them. So no one is particularly at fault here other than the system.
Yes, the system, yeah.
Or back then, the system was at fault in not identifying certain areas with people. And, you know, just because a child couldn't get their heads around how to work out the degree, the area of a triangle, which I can honestly say, I've not ever had to call upon. I can't remember the last time I had to call upon trigonometry.
I'm going to commission a piece from you that is based on trigonometry then.
Just, exactly. I just want 2 square inches.
Yeah. Well, I completely understand that. If you go through a system which is just not serving you properly, I think you should be looking to find the skill that the child has and encourage that. And that, in a way, will encourage all other things. See, I think, for example, you say, I don't know how to work out the size of a triangle. But I think if you'd needed to know that in order to make a piece of jewellery that you wanted to make, or a piece of metalwork you wanted to make, you would have learnt it.
I would have done.
Yeah, there you are, you see. So, in fact, they were approaching it from the wrong direction.
And, of course, and academia, of course, has its place. You know, thank God we have universities. Thank God
Absolutely,
we have people who are intelligent enough to go through GCSEs, go on to A-levels, go through to university, because without of those, having had my life saved twice by the NHS in my life, thank God for these people that are part of the system, because, you know, you can't dosh your way through secondary school and learn how to be a top class surgeon in your dad's garage.
So
you look at the positives of the system, but at the same time, accept that maybe they don't work for everyone.
Well, they didn't work for you, so let's put it in there. That whole secondary thing goes in there and you can forget about it. Well, I think you probably, you know, apart from that dreadful teacher, I always loathe those people.
Yeah.
We've all experienced it. Hopefully children in the future won't have to experience that, because it's something you never forget, that humiliation that teachers can pile on you. For what? In order to make themselves look big.
Yeah.
When in fact, we all knew they weren't.
Yes.
We knew the teachers who were big. We knew the people that were important to us, and they were good teachers. And those few bad pennies could spoil the whole thing. So, yes, let's bury that and let's hope it never happens again. Marvellous. Richard, it's a joy to talk to you. It's an honour, I have to say. I've admired your work through the repair shop, obviously, but I've looked at your website as well, and you do some amazing stuff. I always find it very humbling to talk to somebody with a skill like you have.
Well, thank you so much. It's an immense pleasure to talk to you and let you know what rocks my world.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Richard Talman. Many thanks to Richard for giving me his time, and best of luck with his new venture, Emily's. It was a great pleasure spending time talking to such a skilled man about the things he loves. Well, mostly. I mean, it was all a pleasure, but they were mostly things he loves. Yeah, you can hear all past episodes of this podcast anytime, and if you subscribe, we'll send you the latest episodes as they appear, usually twice a week. Do take a look at Acast Plus if you fancy listening to this podcast without... Sorry, what was that? No, I can't. Not at the moment, no. No. No, I'm recording an end bit for the podcast. Yeah, okay. All right. Yeah, in a minute. Thanks, yeah. Without interruptions. And do join me and My Time Capsule on social media to find out what we're up to. You can download the theme tune for Spotify in its entirety for free. It was written and performed by Pass the Peas Music, which is another guise that my son and producer John Fenton Stevens is known to go under. He produced this podcast and this episode for Acast. And it was a cast-off production, if you're interested in that sort of thing. More episodes soon with all sorts of lovely people. But until then, for anyone suffering from pangs of regret, as we all do from time to time, this is what the great Terry Pratchett said about such thoughts. You can't say if this didn't happen, then that wouldn't have happened, because you don't know everything that might have happened. You might think something would be good, but for all you know, it could have turned out horrible. You can't say, if only I'd... because you could be wishing for anything. The point is, you'll never know. You've gone past.
so there's no use thinking about it. So I don't. I wish I'd said that. Bye!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.